Research and Development Program is a continuing effort to help ensure the survival of this nation. Army industry teamwork is essential to the accomplishment of the Army Research and Development mission. To maintain superiority in our military arsenal, new ideas are essential. New weapons must be developed and perfected to meet new requirements. In these days of explosive advances in science and technology, Army Research and Development plays a major role in maintaining America's military supremacy.
You are saying to the human race, for the first time, an official intelligence representative at a high level from the US government is saying publicly, we are not alone.
We're definitely not alone. Absolutely, the data points empirically that we're not alone, yeah.
You've said that we have, the United States has spacecraft, intact craft.
We do.
Do we have bodies? Do we have species of
non-human? Well, naturally, when you recover something that's either landed or crashed, sometimes you encounter dead pilots.
Well, the book is really my experiences as I lived them in research and development of the Army under General Trudeau, Arthur Trudeau. And he drew me back in and put me in charge of that and established a foreign technology division for me. And these were the artifacts on a crash flying saucer, which we used the word applied engineering. Dr. Teller was still alive, knows he helped him. And we fed these things. He gave me the job of finding industry or scientists that work close to these items and feed us to them in normal R&D projects.
And you're saying these items came from somewhere else?
They came from a flying saucer.
How do you know that?
Because they were marked in the files as coming from New Mexico.
Roswell?
Yeah, Roswell. Well, I think some came, it might have been another crash, but these were, came from New Mexico and Roswell especially. And General Trudeau gave me the job of working out a program, put these things out, feed them to industry, but there was provisions feeding it. They could have the patents, but they had to feed them out back to us as a competitive edge of the Army and to the American people and the world if necessary.
Before the 2023 congressional hearings on UAP, before the Schumer legislation, and before Grush, the 20th century saw a decorated lieutenant colonel of the U.S. Army speak and sign affidavits on the existence of non-human intelligence, crashed UAP, and exploitation of technologies of unknown origin. The legendary Philip J. Corso, in his infamous book The Day After Roswell and lesser-known but far more impactful manuscript Dawn of a New Age, have cemented Corso as one of the most controversial yet credible UFO whistleblowers of all time. Lieutenant Colonel Corso's central claims revolve around his time in the U.S. Army, serving as the chief of the Foreign Technology Division, where he claims he not only came in contact with autopsy reports of extraterrestrial beings, but also craft and artifacts from UAP crashes, and discussed how under his command, technologies found in UAP were seeded into U.S. industry to give the Army a competitive edge. But are Corso's grand and epic claims indeed true? And what can we learn from these claims? What valuable research can be extracted from the names, locations, agencies, incidents, and technologies mentioned by the late Corso? Hey guys, it's UAP Gerb, and I am thrilled for you to join me as we fully analyze and deconstruct the testimony of Philip J. Corso and his claims of UAP crash retrieval, NHI biologics, and reverse engineering of exotic technologies. Let's conduct a comprehensive deep dive into Corso, ranging from carefully analyzing statements made in his manuscript to digging through his military record and grand claims. And some quick bookkeeping before we get started today. We are taking the global bestseller The Day After Roswell, co-written by Corso, and throwing it out the window. We will instead be focusing solely on Dawn of a New Age, the original notes and manuscript of Corso released in Italy in 2003 and the US in 2011, after Corso's death in 1998 at the age of 83. We will do this so we can directly study Corso's pure claims without the creative liberties taken in The Day After Roswell, possibly inserted by the other co-writer, Bill Burns. According to Corso's son, Philip Jr., he originally had no plans to release his father's manuscript, but did due to his father's distaste for the bestseller. As relayed by Junior, Corso went through the day after Roswell and highlighted everything he did not say or did not like. He got solely halfway through before giving up due to frustration with the book. Multiple individuals were privy to the manuscript before Corso's death, such as Colonel John B. Alexander, who remarked on sensational details featured in the book missing in the manuscript. Due to the existence of the manuscript and Corso's son's firm remarks of releasing the piece to correct the mistakes in the book that made his father furious during his lifetime, we must give Corso the benefit of the doubt and study solely his unfiltered words. For example, The Day After Roswell is 130 pages longer than Dawn of a New Age, whilst the two cover roughly the same concepts. Day After Roswell adds in details like recounting the time when Corso intimidated the CIA director of covert operations into self-deleting. The manuscript features no such tale. Another example is the book originally shipped with a foreword written by U.S. Senator Strom Thurmond, who angrily recounted his statements once learning the book centered on UAP, leading to an early copy reprint. While the manuscript makes mention of Corso's relationship to Thurmond, no such advocation by the senator was ever mentioned. A final example I'll discuss is the missing first chapter from the book, The Roswell Desert, which describes the Roswell, New Mexico UFO crash in painstaking detail, and passes it off as an accurate description, even though Corso was not present at this event. So feel free to visit the video description and download both the book and the manuscript and follow along as we dive into the claims of Corso. Philip Corso has as ironclad a background in the U.S. Armed Forces and military intelligence as does David Grush. Few other witnesses, even with proven accolades in the U.S. military, such as Roswell witness Walter Haught of the 509th Bomb Group, come close to matching Corso's rank, stations, and history. Lieutenant Colonel Corso served in the U.S. Army from February 23, 1942 to March 1, 1963. The young man initially served in military intelligence during Europe in World War II before becoming chief of the U.S. Counterintelligence Corps, CIC, in Rome. At the end of the Second World War, Corso arranged safe passage for numerous Jewish refugees out of Rome and served as personal emissary to Giovanni Battista Montini, who would become Pope Paul VI. Corso also served diligently in the early 1950s throughout the Korean War, performing intelligence directly under General Douglas MacArthur as chief of the Special Projects Branch of the Intelligence Division Far East Command. His work here would focus mainly on prisoners of war, POWs, and missing in action MIA soldiers during the war, tasked with investigating North Korean POW camps and investigating the number of U.S. and UN POWs held at each camp. Phil would even testify in 1992 before the Senate Select Committee on POW-MIA Affairs on hundreds of American soldiers being abandoned at these camps. Corso served on the staff of President Eisenhower's National Security Council for 4 years from 1953 to 1957. Skeptics and detractors of Corso claimed he was never a member of this NSC under Eisenhower. However, the 1992 Senate Select Committee hearing report would say otherwise, where the retired lieutenant colonel was clearly listed as NSC staff under the Eisenhower administration. We can also analyze Corso's own FOIA'd military documents, which show him as a member of the Operations Coordinating Board, a U.S. secret covert operations committee established in 1952 by Eisenhower under Executive Order 10483, which reported directly to the National Security Council. In 1960, Corso joined and shortly became commander of the Army's Pentagon-based research and development program, the illustrious Foreign Technology Division, under Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau. This Foreign Technology Division is not the Air Force's infamous Foreign Technology Division born out of the Air Force Technical Intelligence Center at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. This program stems from the Office of the Chief of Army R&D and has almost zero trace or record outside of Corso's own military documents, and we'll discuss this much further later on. I do briefly want to mention some interesting context to lend to the credibility of Corso as we dive into his claims. Viewers of my channel will know of my recent interview with Dr. Eric Davis of the Wilson-Davis Memo, where Davis intimately discussed President and former CIA Director George H.W. Bush's involvement with UAP legacy programs. Well, let's reference Jacques Vallée's book, Forbidden Science: Pacific Heights, which speaks on Eric Davis and former President Bush Sr.'s professional relationship. After a candid call initiated by Bush giving Davis advice on his future career, the two spoke again and saw Davis ask Bush about his interest in Corso's disclosures. Quote, could it be that Corso was mistaken in dealing with the material he was handling? Could that have been Nazi hardware? End quote. Shockingly, to the statement on Corso, Bush replied, quote, impossible. The two topics were clearly separated. By that time, all German secrets had been processed and filed away. They were not used as cover for anything else, end quote. Bush expanded on the 1954 alleged landing of non-human intelligence at Holloman Air Force Base, where allegedly Eisenhower and NHI brokered a deal. According to Bush, this event really did happen, resulting in a secret project with obscene security. When the two spoke again, Bush told Davis he was briefed on legacy programs by Trudeau at the time of the 1968 Mendel Rivers congressional hearings. The book says Colonel Trudeau, however, I do think this is a typo referencing General Arthur Trudeau. Bush Sr. claimed Trudeau told him his man Corso had been asked to testify before Congress and was able to reveal rumblings of alien hardware that had been distributed to industrial labs. The Corso testimony was squashed as a result of this conversation. And lastly, why did Corso wait until the 1990s to disclose his experiences with UAP technology? Well, this is because he made a promise to Trudeau he would wait to speak until his death.
What about the few people who have criticized you? They're saying, well, why are you coming out now? You're violating your security oath. What are you telling us?
I've been asked that question many, many times.
I know.
Number one is I had an oath with a general, so we wouldn't discuss this. A general said, when I die, feel your release from your oath. He died 3 years ago, and I started to write it. Number two is I couldn't talk about people who were with us that I had no right to talk about. In intelligence, like a newspaper man, your source is not named unless he gives you permission to name him. I had no right to do that. And so my own family criticized. My son says, 35 years you didn't talk. You didn't even tell us. So that's right. Why should I tell anybody? I had an oath with an honorable man, a great man. And I wasn't about to betray that oath. And not only that, I had never any intention of writing a book or putting it on paper. It never entered my mind when I was in the military. I never thought I'd write a book or even do a movie on it. That never entered my head.
Shortly before his death in July of 1998, CAUS, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, published an affidavit released by Colonel Corso. This affidavit was signed for attorney Peter A. Gersten of CAUS in order to file a lawsuit against the Department of Army. This affidavit reads, quote, I, Colonel Philip J. Corso, retired, do hereby swear under the penalties of perjury that the following statements are true. That all times hereinafter mentioned, I was a member and officer of the defendant. That during my tenure with the defendant, I was a member of President Eisenhower's National Security Council and former head of the Foreign Technology Desk at Defendant's Research and Development Department. That on or about July 6, 1947, while stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas, I personally observed a 4-foot non-human creature with bizarre-looking 4-fingered hands, thin legs and feet, and an oversized incandescent light bulb-shaped head. The eye sockets were oversized and almond-shaped and pointed down to its tiny nose. The creature's skull was overgrown to the point where all its facial features were arranged frontally, occupying only a small circle on the lower part of the head. There were no eyebrows or any indications of facial hair. The creature had only a tiny flat slit for a mouth and it was completely closed, resembling more of a crease or indentation between the nose and bottom of the chinless skull than a fully functioning orifice. That in 1961, I came into possession of what I refer to as the Roswell file. This file contained field reports, medical autopsy reports, and technical debris from the crash of an extraterrestrial vehicle in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. That I have personally read the medical autopsy reports, which refer to the autopsy of the previously described creature that I saw in 1947 at Fort Riley, Kansas. That the autopsy reports indicated the autopsy was performed at Walter Reed Hospital, which was under the authority of the defendant at the time of the autopsy.
that the autopsy report referred to the creature as an extraterrestrial biological entity.
Right off the bat here, it sounds extreme. Corso claimed to have observed a mangled body he would later learn was a deceased being from the 1947 Roswell, New Mexico crash. If you are not well versed with the July 1947 Roswell UAP crash retrieval, I do recommend doing some homework before continuing with this project. I'd recommend the Roswell cover-up 75 years later, as well as my project, UFO Whistleblowers Volume 1, to hear from some credible whistleblowers on the incident. For this video, we will be utilizing an array of interesting depictions of the crashed Roswell saucer, based on reports and eyewitness testimony. Corso solely labeled the craft as the Roswell crashed saucer in Dawn of a New Age. We will explore all of these craft design in a future project solely focused on Roswell.
One night, I was post-duty officer. Post-duty officer means that I was in control. For that night, I was the one that checked all the guards, checked all security areas. In fact, checked the whole post. I was the duty officer that night. And I went to the veterinarian section, and one of a sergeant I knew very well was sergeant of the guard that night. I told him, "Sarge, how's everything around here?" And he said, "Fine, sir." I told him, "You know, they told me to be careful to watch this area because you have a sense of something sensitive here." He said, "You want to see it, sir?" I told him, "Yes, let's go look." And I knew this sergeant very well. He was a master sergeant. I went back, and there was five crates there, like five or six, I think it was five. I lifted one up, and here's this body there and floating in fluid. And I looked at it about 10, 15 seconds, not much more than that. So I put it back down and I said, "Sarge, come on, get out of here now. I want to get you in trouble. Because I'm the duty officer, I can go around, walk around here. But you might get in trouble for coming back. Just come on, let's go. Come out with me." So we went out. And I told him, "Where did it come from, Sarge?" He said, "Well, five trucks came through, like coming through here from an airfield in New Mexico. And they're heading for Wright-Patterson Air Force." Now, in those days, you know, there weren't all these big roads now. In those days, Route 40 was about the only cross-country route. And the route that they took was Route 40, going through Fort Riley, Kansas, and then up to Wright-Patterson Air Force. And I thought, "Well, stay away from her, Sarge. I don't want you to get in any trouble." I told him, "I can walk around and see that." So, and I started to figure, what was that? First, I thought it was a child, because it was small. Then I looked at this head and all, right away, and this was only happened a matter of seconds. Then I put the end back down, and the head was different, the arms were spindly, the body, it was gray. So, right at that moment, I figured, I don't know what this thing is.
Corso's official records do indeed place him at Fort Riley at this date, and he would claim he was told the convoy of trucks hauling the bodies were headed for Wright Pat and came from Route 40. This is very interesting, as quite often Roswell reports state wreckage was flown to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Were deceased biologics transported separately, and if so, why? Myriad UFO crash retrieval stories feature flatbed Air Force and Army trucks hauling wreckage away, such as the 1953 Kingman and 1965 Kecksburg crash retrievals. Also an interesting line I'm sure many picked up. The body was referred to as an EBE, extraterrestrial biological entity, the same phrase used in the Majestic 12 Special Operations Manual. This manual describes two sets of EBE, EBE 1 and 2. EBE-1 closely matches the description of Corso's observed body. This affidavit provides little more information than Corso gaining first-hand knowledge of the Roswell crash, but fortunately we have his entire manuscript to study. Just to revisit, the bulk of Corso's testimony revolves around the U.S. Army's Foreign Technology Division serving to exploit technology of unknown origin, TUO, from crashed UAP and seed it into U.S. industry to primarily bolster the U.S. Army war machine and, as a second directive, benefit the U.S. economy.
Through this program, we start feeding it out to industry. But this was not known, not on paper. They went out as normal research and development proposals, not to name something.
Yeah, you didn't put out a report that said, here's some alien stuff, figure it out.
We put our regular research and development proposal that came from somebody's brain. And also, this was known among a select few. mostly combat officers, head to head. It came, we kept this among ourselves, because otherwise we were certain that they would have destroyed our organization, and we had a good organization. General Trudeau pulled it together just a couple years before. They were a destroyed organization and labeled us as kooks and taking our budget away. So it had to be. We didn't cover because we gave it to industry with the provisions, and I'll repeat this. The provisions were to come back to us with what you prove, competitive edge of the Army, give it to the people and to the world if necessary, and take the patents.
This claim, dating to 1962, parallels extremely closely the modern-day disclosures that branches of U.S. military work closely with contractors under unacknowledged waived special access program in order to exploit technologies of unknown origin to primarily benefit the U.S. military. Let's monitor this evolution closely as we explore Corso. It is endlessly fascinating to compare the secrecy and centralization of technology exploitation programs under the Foreign Technology Division as outlined by Corso, all the way to how these UAP legacy programs may operate today, stovepiped and protected from congressional oversight, nestled within various intelligence agencies and military institutions in league with defense contractors, UARCs, and FFRDCs. Anyways, to the memo. After a brief foreword and acknowledgement with the awesome statement, quote, "If one passage in these memoirs helps you survive in a troubled world, then all this work is not in vain," end quote, Corso begins an introduction for the reader. Philip begins by giving the reader valuable insight into the creation of Army research and development projects exploiting technologies of unknown origin. And guys, moving forward, research and development will now be shortened to R&D, and technologies of unknown origin will be shortened to TUOs. This sort of inception of a legacy UAP program gives us a framework to understand the construction and evolution of such programs. Corso also quotes the father of German rocketry, flying saucer researcher, and mentor of Wernher von Braun, Hermann Oberth, who once stated, quote, "We cannot take the credit for our record advancements in certain scientific fields alone. We have been helped by people of other worlds," end quote. 1947 to 1958 saw the disorganized dark ages of Army research and development. NASA was founded in 1958, killing the Army and DoD Project Horizon, which served to build a moon base. Atomic energy was stripped from the Army and handed over to the Atomic Energy Commission. ARPA, the Advanced Project Research Agency, was also founded, clashing often with Army R&D. It wasn't until 1958 all Army R&D was pooled under one single department, the Office of the Chief of Army R&D. This was Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, who handled all personnel, tech services, laboratory, and installations, as well as budget. Trudeau would then create the Foreign Technology Division and designate young Corso as its chief. Corso would take, quote, "all reports on foreign technology, which included foreign beings and events, those not of this world," end quote. We will discuss this station and division in much greater detail later in the project, but for now we are focusing solely on the manuscript's introduction. This led, according to Corso, to the golden age of Army R&D from 58 to 63. However, in this time, the Army still faced many challenges impeding their work. Civilian control of space efforts, DoD opposers, adverse policy guidance, and the animosity of CIA Department of State. This would all lead to the hyper-secrecy of all R&D data pertaining to areas out of this world. All of these materials were compartmentalized and trusted amongst a select few, quote, "Great efforts were made to bring large industry and select laboratories into the Army R&D fold," end quote. Corso also states, quote, "The partners we sought and gathered were U.S. industry, a strong laboratory support, and many leading universities," end quote. I do believe this small line is one of the most crucial aspects of Corso's testimony, believe it or not. Quite often on this channel, we talk not only about contractors involved in UAP legacy programs, but also university-affiliated research centers, as well as federally funded research and development centers, semi-private institutions. One such organization created during this golden age of Army R&D is an FFRDC I believe is up to their eyeballs in UAP legacy programs, MITRE. Officially established in 1958, MITRE was created by MIT Lincoln Labs employees creating SAGE, the Semi-Automatic Ground Environment Program, to coordinate radars to produce imageries of airspace for the military. A thesis I'd like to keep in mind during this exploration was the MITRE FFRDC created in part to fulfill the need of Army UFO R&D to see technology into U.S. industry. Of course, the Foreign Technology Division was created a year later in 1960. However, Corso does state before his station at the new office, material exploitation efforts by the Army had been ongoing since Roswell. At an undisclosed date, but presumably around the time or just before the creation of the Foreign Technology Division in 1960, Corso states the top 25 industries on the Fortune 500 list were contacted and meetings were arranged with their board of directors, top personnel, with the chiefs of Army R&D. Laboratories were strengthened and organized, gathering funds to attract the best and brightest, including foreign scientists such as those brought from Operation Paperclip. With contractors such as Bell Labs, who is credited with the development of the transistor and laser, two technologies Corso said were leveraged from UAP, alongside universities and Army laboratories. This conglomeration, a powerful team, was tasked with exploiting TUOs. The guiding principle of this Army project had but two goals: national security of the United States and protection of the American way of life. In a rare Art Bell coast-to-coast interview with Corso and Colonel John B. Alexander, Corso would state the Foreign Technology Division began to operate with a budget of $2 billion.
So you just sent it over and said, figure it out?
Yes, we gave it to our labs.
And it was
our labs.
And once again, they weren't doing this gratis or for an investigation. You were commissioning them. You had budget money.
Exactly.
Research and development money that came along with these items you were giving them.
We had a budget then that was tremendous. It was about $2 billion.
$2 billion.
Now, we also gave out RDT&D contracts, Research, Development, Test, and Evaluation contracts. The first item that would be built from a research contract, we funded the building to the first one. Then after that, other people, and you know, other agencies funded it. So we would fund these until it was actually developed. And we had our own laboratories, our atomic labs, and the night viewing labs were our labs at Fort Belvoir.
So Colonel, what aspect of this were you overseeing? In other words, once you gave somebody a piece of this technology and a budget, what did you then do?
Well, I was supposed to keep track of it, of how it was coming along.
This RDT&E funding would equal over $10.5 billion today, quite the starting budget. The mention of R&D test and evaluation contracts reminds me closely of Witness Ed, who made claims of a joint UAP reverse engineering group operating between Nellis/Area 51 and Edwards Air Force bases. After his service in the Edwards 412th group, Ed would work for USAF at the Pentagon, serving on acquisition integration and RDT&E panel. It was here Ed would claim $34 and $40 billion were siphoned off in respective years to non-Air Force TOA transfer of authority funds. Here in the introduction, Corso breaks down some of the breakthroughs leveraged from the Foreign Technology Division and Golden Age of R&D from studying reports and wreckage from Roswell and possibly other UAP recoveries. Let's go ahead and break these down. The first technology are image intensifiers, aka passive night vision devices. Corso stated the Night Vision Laboratory at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, created these first generation devices with aid from 48 U.S. industries, all with varying knowledge of the project. Allegedly, information gathered from the 1947 Roswell crash led to this breakthrough. Passive systems were indeed constructed by the U.S. Army in the early 1960s. However, many individuals, such as Colonel John B. Alexander, challenged this statement. One of the most contentious technologies discussed by Corso is fiber optics. This point of Corso's testimony has been highly contentious, like much of the materials. Allegedly at Roswell, the recovery team discovered what they thought to be a broken wiring harness, with each loose strand end emitting a different color. These wires were fiber optics. Bell Labs allegedly utilized this technology to spearhead the greatest advancements in communication history. Now, this point is contentious because French scientists were indeed working on early developments of fiber optic principles in the early 1840s. Bell Labs was involved in the development of fiber optics in the 1970s, where they improved the technology and minimized loss on mass scale production. Now let's keep in mind, Corso does say some of the non-human technologies leveraged were used to bolster human technology, so perhaps this drastic Bell Labs improvement is one of these instances. And speaking of Bell Labs, let's remember back to the testimony of Edgar Fouché, who stated that FFRDC's Livermore Labs and Sandia National Labs reverse-engineered the propulsion system for the TR-3B alien reproduction vehicle. According to the Majestic 12 documents and the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit report, Sandia has also served as a prime site for UAP crash retrieval and reverse engineering operations. In fact, I have spoken so much about Sandia, I highly recommend committing them and FFRDCs in general to memory. The telephone company AT&T was given managerial responsibilities of Sandia National Labs by President Harry Truman in 1949. As of 1925, Bell Labs and their engineering R&D department was placed under shared ownership of Western Electric and AT&T. Very interesting connections here. Another alleged leverage technology were super tenacity fibers from one single strand of fiber that could not be damaged. The Army at that time, according to Corso, had a tremendous need for fibers for flak jackets, parachutes, and other military items. Important to note, Dawn of a New Age states these fibers were utilized to construct composites for stealth technology and civilian aircraft, while Day After Roswell states these fibers were used to construct Kevlar, the material in bulletproof vest and made by DuPont in 1965. Strange molecular alignment techniques were additionally studied from the Roswell crash. The craft showed molecules down to individual atoms had been aligned in various patterns, resulting in incredible hardness and resistance to scratches, stress, strain, and shear in metals while all repelling cosmic particles and radiation. The chief of R&D of the Army thought this to be a truly consequential discovery, and thus special teams were organized to investigate this chemistry. Corso stated this atomic rearrangement could lead to incredibly strong yet light spacecraft, but in 1963, and possibly through 1993, the Army had not solved this issue. I personally have heard some similar claims that non-human craft employ materials with interesting atomic arrangements. Corso also believed fluid amplication was leveraged from UFO propulsion and guidance systems. Fluidic principles led to the creation of the heart pump. Even though fluidic principles are quite old, they were not utilized commercially until about 1960 for the demand for reliable controls in space research. Two of the greatest technologies exploited by Army R&D, according to Corso, were the transistor and integrated circuit. As we mentioned above, Bell Labs first introduced a point contact transistor in 1947. Jack Kirby of Texas Instruments introduced the first hybrid integrated circuit between 1958 and 1959. Corso's testimony illustrates a strange transistor with hair-like wires and leads, and a chip in a stack of thin, uniformly shaped wafer-like components found in a crash retrieval. Quote, "These formed complete electrical circuits and developed into the micromodule concept. CRD said it would take 50 years to develop the transistor and 200 years to develop the chip. It came in a short span of 5 years," end quote. Corso does state this development occurred before the golden age of Army R&D, 1958 to 1963, with advancements as early as 1947. As he states, improvements were made to the existing technologies in 1959 with the introduction of miniaturization of circuits. In fact, when Corso began his service as special assistant to Trudeau in 1960, Trudeau would allegedly show him both transistors and integrated circuits and engage in some philosophical discussion on the implications of harnessing off-world technologies for human use. Perhaps this does indeed adhere to conventional history, which states physicist Julius Edgar Lilienfeld proposed the concept of a field effect transistor, an FET, in 1926. But it was not possible to construct a working device at that time. It was not until 1947 we saw application of transistors. The Lieutenant Colonel also stated the laser, who many program members suggested was the EBE's method of communication over vast distances of space, was derived from the Roswell crash. As we know, the laser, which stands for Light Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Radiation, was created in 1960 under Bell Labs. And again, what was the purpose of all of this R&D, in Corso's own words, quote, "To guarantee a superior competitive position for our Army, given the superior data by the accidental discovery at Roswell, we reduce scientific data to a definite development to fulfill a military requirement. We never quibbled over who discovered or invented a development. The feeling was if a discovery was adapted to a concrete development, we would all be ahead in the game and the nation would benefit," end quote. This reminds me almost identically of the claims made by David Grush regarding secrecy of legacy program operations.
So the reason for the secrecy exactly is what?
Feudalistic dominance, who can have both asymmetric technology for, it seems like, just fueling the war machine.
Grush says that through the 50s and 60s, encounters with the NHI continued, as did the cover-up.
Key to mention here, it is stated in the manuscript extraterrestrials never gave humans a thing. Not one scientific advantage came voluntarily. Everything was garnered by accident, or perhaps force in some cases. This raises a very interesting point. Numerous individuals, such as David Grush, have flirted with the subject of agreements with humans and non-human intelligence. If these agreements do not involve technology, what do they involve?
And it's quite clear that you're talking about agreements between America and non-human intelligences. Have we made agreements with non-human intelligences?
That's the kind of information I really hope national leadership is able to get to the bottom of.
I need to pin you down on this. Are there agreements between non-human intelligences and the American government?
I think that's a question that I would like to know all the details of as well.
Or is it possible R&D programs were kept separate from other compartmentalized programs that inherited technology, a separation of programs I believe is active today?
I think something a lot of people don't ask that has kind of captured my attention. During your time investigating legacy programs, did you see much collaboration or compartmentalization between programs that may exist in Navy, Air Force, Army?
It's too stovepiped or compartmentalized. You can't open it up to another one unless there is a need to do that. And that's that need to get access is defined on a government form called the DD-254. And the DD-254 documents who has access and why and what gets access. And if you're going to have to get access to another compartmentalized program, then that has to be justified in the DD-254. And usually that's not justified because programs don't really overlap.
However, Corso's claims NHI technology was taken, not inherited, mirrors closely the claims of Fluxliner alien reproduction vehicle witness Brad Sorensen, who was told at the 1988 Norton Air Show the basis for the ARV, the Roswell wreckage, was taken without the consent of its operators. Another interesting parallel to today is a contractor Corso makes numerous mentions to, the Sperry Rand Corporation. Not to be confused with the Rand FFRDC, Sperry Rand was a major 20th century electronics corporation and military contractor. Sperry Rand was additionally named in General Trudeau's memoirs as a frequent spot for meetings. He would often meet with their CEO and directors to discuss Army R&D projects. One such director was the legendary General Douglas MacArthur. Sperry Rand went defunct in 1986, and many of its divisions became part of Honeywell, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. Corso then goes on to mention a long list of other benefits garnered from UFO technology exploration. One I want to mention is anti-missile missiles for the Star Wars program. Long have I stated the Star Wars program, formerly known as the Strategic Defense Initiative, had a secondary function to fund UAP programs and act offensively against UAP. There is indeed interesting research to suggest although the program was set in place by Reagan in 1983, Eisenhower established the program for UAP offensive action during his presidency. The colonel discussed the need for protection against the EBEs themselves. The lieutenant colonel stated EBEs have performed acts of war with superior advanced equipment and superior techniques. The threat internally was treated similar to the Soviets as a fig leaf policy, where the Soviets and non-human threatened existence but were not considered enemies. These acts included the controversial abduction phenomena and mutilation, as well as, quote, spying on our atomic installations, hindering missile and space equipment testing, hampering our military deterrent and nuclear deterrent, halting and interfering with exploration of Moon and Mars, causing crashes of aircraft and casualties among military personnel, and tampering with human and animal genome, end quote. I would like to explore some of these more controversial claims in a future project, so let's hold on to this. This passage is key to reflect on, as in the revelations of David Grush, we have heard people have been hurt and killed by UAP, but cannot attribute malicious intent to these intelligences. To conclude with the introduction, Corso placed much admiration for the individuals behind Exotic R&D. These veterans of World War II and Korea were entrusted with the United States government's highest level, deepest secrets. Now that we have spent over half an hour investigating the introduction of the manuscript, we can start to dive in and explore more of Corso's claims in depth. Throughout the introduction of this document, we heard Corso recount for the reader much of his early military career, but quickly let's recap some of his highlights right before he met General Trudeau in his own words.
Well, your career to the point that you met the general was a very honorable and fairly normal military career.
It was in combat at this time. We were fighting the war in North Africa, in Italy. And then I joined the general. I went to Korea. I participated in the Korean War, and I joined MacArthur's staff over there. Then I came back, and when I came back to the States, I joined President Eisenhower as one of his military aides and national security council at the White House. And there my career sort of changed. I was in the White House for 4 years. And from there I took command of the missile battalion, the Army's missile firing range of White Sands.
Mm-hmm.
Then I took the combat missile battalion and my other atomic warheads even to Germany. And I stayed in command 18 months and then I became Inspector General of the 7th Army. And from there I came back to the United States. General Trudeau had reorganized research and development of the Army, and he sent for me, and I joined him as a special assistant and chief of the Foreign Technology Division.
Corso claimed his military career saw him earn 9 clearance levels above top secret, up to the coveted eyes-only material for the White House NSC Matters. Achieving these clearances is when the Lieutenant Colonel would claim he became aware of UFO information. Though nothing pertaining to legacy programs or reverse engineering, since his NSC position occurred from 1953 to 1957, we can wager any interesting UFO information was presented to him as Intelligence Staff O for the Operations Coordinating Board attached to the National Security Council. Corso claimed his superior and the President's Special Assistant C.D. Jackson, along with President Eisenhower himself, were the only individuals aware of Corso's clearances. C.D. Jackson here is Charles Douglas Jackson, Special Assistant to Eisenhower and Government Psychological Warfare Advisor. Jackson served as liaison between the freshly minted CIA and the Pentagon. Jackson was also a member of the Committee on International Information Activities. Corso did discuss how in officer school he began specializing in air defense and ballistic missiles. Twice during his command of missile units, unidentified objects were picked up over New Mexico and Germany, traveling at over 3,000 miles per hour. Corso was ordered to destroy any records and tapes. Following service as commander of the 71st Missile Battalion in Germany and Inspector General of the 7th Army, Corso was led to become Special Assistant to the Chief of Army R&D, Lieutenant General Arthur G. Trudeau, quote, "If Edwin Teller could be called the father of the H-bomb, General Trudeau could be called the father of the ballistic missile," end quote. And now we can get into some of the very juicy details. In 1960, Corso entered into his position as chief of the Foreign Technology Division, having seen a small, strange body, while also being read into some unknown UFO information due to his clearance levels, and had been told of some exotic technologies leveraged from off-world technologies by his mentor and boss, Arthur Trudeau. But I do find it strange Corso does not write about the 1947 non-human intelligence body encounter in Dawn of a New Age, as we observed in his signed affidavit. This is especially strange because this encounter of biologics was relayed in the book Day After Roswell, so I guess let's go back and hear this story recounted in Corso's own words.
And I was instructor at the intelligence school, and we had an aggressor force one night, I was a post-duty officer. Post-duty officer means that I was in control. For that night, I was the one that checked all the guards, checked all security areas. In fact, checked the whole post. I was a duty officer that night. And I went to the veterinarian section, and a sergeant I knew very well was sergeant of the guard that night. I told him, "Sarge, how's everything around here?" And he said, "Fine, sir." I told him, they told me to be careful to watch this area because you have a sense of something sensitive here. He said, you want to see it, sir? I told him, yeah, let's go look. And I knew the sergeant, right? He was a master sergeant. I went back, and there was five crates there, like five or six. I think it was five. I lifted one up, and here's this body there and floating in fluid. And I looked at it about 10, 15 seconds, not much more than that. So I put it back down. I said, Sarge, come on, get out of here now. I want to get you in trouble. Because I'm the duty officer. I can go around, walk around here. But you might get in trouble for coming back. Just come on, let's go. Come out with me. So we went out. And I told him, where did it come from, Sarge? He said, well, five trucks came through, like coming through here from an airfield in New Mexico. And they're heading for Wright-Patterson Air Force. Now, in those days, you know, there weren't all these big roads now. In those days, Route 40 was about the only cross-country route. And the route that they took was Route 40, going through Fort Riley, Kansas, and then up to Wright-Patterson Air Force. And I said, well, stay away from her, Sarge. I don't want you to get in any trouble. I told him, I can walk around and see. So, and I started to figure, what was that? First, I thought it was a child, because it was small. Then I looked at this head and all, right away, and this was only happened a matter of seconds. Then I put the end back down, and the head was different, the arms were spindly, the body, it was gray. So right at that moment, I figured, I don't know what this thing is. So like an intelligence business, I just better put it in the back of my head here and wait till maybe in the future I get cooperation so I can evaluate what it is.
As chief of the Foreign Technology Division, the young lieutenant colonel would receive, quote, all reports on foreign technology which included foreign beings and events, those not of this world, end quote. He would spearhead a team of Nazi scientists brought over from Operation Paperclip, as well as U.S. scientists and technicians. Some of these pieces of technology were known to be from crashed UFOs, while others were educated guesses. Corso did recognize his position arose almost exclusively from his close relationship with the infamous Trudeau. In fact, Trudeau personally gave Corso what is now famously known as the Roswell file, a box of materials and files pertaining to the infamous crash.
Called me in one day, he said, we'll make you chief of Foreign Technology Division. And you're going to inherit a three-drawer file. Now, why don't you go through that file and look what's there, and you give me a program and tell me what you think they are. So I take this file to my office downstairs from his office, the second floor in the Pentagon, and I open it up and I start finding this material, which he called later, of course, it was junk. Well, and it was bunch of wires, which I didn't even know what they were, which were emitting in colors. I didn't even know if they were wires. I had this chip, this integrated circuit, a laser instrument. They could do like some of the fine cuttings that they said in manual manipulations. And I had also fiber optics, something that I had those. And we called them, we started that because one of my, and I had reports on an autopsy that performed at Walter Reed on our lab, which we financed at Walter Reed. And when I read that, it matched with what I saw at Fort Riley 14 years before. The whole autopsy was similar to what I'd seen. So then I start putting two and two together. And gradually these items will start, but then the general called me and said, work out a program. Find scientists and that are working on these things and shove them in there. I told them, but General, I have to study these things all because really, I told him, I'm not that bright. I don't know what these things, a lot of these things are, but they're important. He said, well, Phil, they are important. Give me a program what they are.
Anyways, after Corso was designated as the chief of the Foreign Technology Division by Trudeau in 1960, Corso was given four subjects to keep track of. One, foreign development of this world. 2. Foreign intelligence and developments not of this world. 3. Act as interim project officer on select R&D projects. And 4. All other duties assigned as special assistant to the CRD for the U.S. Army. National security measures meant points 1, 3, and 4 fell into normal categories, but point 2 was a whole different matter. many experts in the know felt the Army was helpless in the face of NHI technology. Let's briefly touch on some more technologies and items featured in the Roswell report given to Corso by Trudeau we have yet to discuss. Amongst the physical technologies and reports on artifacts such as a paper-thin high-strength medal found at the Roswell crash, Corso discovered autopsy reports discussing beings almost identical to what he observed in 1947. Accompanying images showed decomposed bodies roughly 4 feet tall, and medical reports detailed heavy variations to human anatomy and organs, as well as skin and bone composition. These biologics' heart and lungs were very large, with a remarkably different muscular structure. The beings appeared to have skin and bone structure built to protect vital organs from cosmic action, cosmic radiation, or gravitational pull. And it is interesting, according to the manuscript, a transparent film over the eyeball of the deceased EBEs led to Trudeau mandating the pursuit of passive night vision technology. Analyzing every single file he had on the Roswell crash saucer, Corso did notice some odd discrepancies between the beings and their craft. The files had no mention of food or nourishment for the beings in the craft, nor mention of water or drinking water, or water for cleansing the body. The files made no mention to refrigeration equipment, no mention of medical equipment besides what the recovery crew guessed was a first aid kit, and there was no toilet or waste disposal facilities, or no rest and no recreation facilities. Corso and the OCRD believed these beings to be clones, or at the very least expendable creatures sent by some sort of intelligence. The chief even believed the Roswell craft to be a reconnaissance craft that would return to a mothership for necessities. The lieutenant colonel also reasoned possibly this species had solved gravitational time-dimensional travel and could instantaneously return to their base. Throughout the manuscript, Corso would often hint at multiple UAP or crashed flying saucers analyzed. It is frustrating we don't get a total count. Besides confirmation of the Roswell crash as well as the 1947 July San Agustin, New Mexico crash, in which allegedly a flying saucer crashed with no seams, joint lines, rivets, or weld joints. This is a ubiquitous description in almost all UFO crash retrieval reports.
So when I start putting all this, all the extra terrestrial together, we finally gave it a name. I told them, it looks like, you know, these are clones. And so the name came out, extraterrestrial biological entity. That's what we figured they were. Better describe it. We never used the letters ET. There was no such thing.
You said that they look like clones.
How? They were clones. Not look like clones. They were clones. We figured that they were created by some other intellect. And we also came to the decision that they were made specifically to travel in space. Because we knew even in those days that man could not travel in space. His bones are affected, his muscles are affected, his brain is affected. Man cannot travel in space. So we came to the conclusion that these creatures, whatever they are made to travel in space. And gradually, through the work we did, we found out that disintegrated with the flying saucer, and really, because most of the failures making flying saucers were the guidance system. But this creature was also the guidance system, was part of the engine of the flying saucer.
It is also fascinating to see how the team was inspired and attempted to study harnessing brainwaves to control aircraft and anti-missile missiles. This inspiration came from apparent discoveries that these extraterrestrial biological entities were part of the craft's guidance systems. This may seem like science fiction, however, we do live in an age where consciousness connection is indeed discussed with UFO craft piloting.
And we came to a conclusion even in those days that the reason most flying saucers have failed is because our conclusion was that this being is part of the guidance system. He's part of that saucer.
I've just had one of the most senior scientists in the U.S. Defense Department, former, admit to me that he was read into a UFO crash retrieval program. I've spoken to well over 20 people now. What I was told consistently was the technology is mind-blowing and they are not in a position to be able to engineer it yet, because it's just light years beyond what we have. It's a completely new type of physics, is what one person said to me. And you might be interested in this, Jay, because of the sort of direction that your interests have taken. Without expanding on it, one of the people I spoke to told me that it had a lot to do with a mind interface connection with the engineering, that it was driven by some kind of consciousness or some kind of intelligent connection with machinery that was beyond our understanding.
Shockingly, we can add even more context to these claims by analyzing the files of the legendary Leonard Stringfield and take a look at a report of a possible recovered vehicle or alien reproduction vehicle that utilized headband transceivers to operate. Quote, Len spoke to a Mr. Hines who had a source from Bell Labs. The informant stated that he was on the flight line at a California Air Force base in the early 1950s and saw a UFO retrieval brought in. He allegedly saw a cutaway of the recovered craft plus the headband transceivers worn by the aliens. Anyone involved with the retrieval was subject to intense scrutiny and search. Apparently, one man must have kept a part of the craft and he mysteriously disappeared. He was never seen again. The source feels that the man was eliminated, end quote. Chief Corso somehow stumbled upon information that the Soviets were running their own parallel TUO exploitation program. This may have stemmed from Soviet spies in New Mexico tipping off Stalin to the Roswell crash, where Stalin allegedly gathered the USSR's brightest to discuss the captured saucer. Quote, some of the items found and analyzed by the Russians possess a similarity of items gathered in the United States. Others closely resemble material collected by the U.S. Army soon after the crash, end quote. Impactful statement, as recently Dr. Eric Davis confirmed the Soviets did indeed observe and collect at least one crash retrieval in their own territory. It is unknown how exactly Corso came across this intelligence regarding the Soviets, but it is no surprise after the words of David Grush.
Grush says the United States is not the only country that's encountered NHI and their technology. He says our geopolitical rivals have their own crash retrieval programs, which they are also secretly exploiting for military purposes.
We're in a competition with their adversaries to understand this. And it's a multi-decade Cold War that has been under our nose for so long. And, you know, there is no good way to level the playing field and hold other nation states accountable if they're doing unethical or illicit activity as it relates to this subject.
However, far down the line in 1993, Corso would ask old acquaintances to acquire about recovered materials from a KGB general. While much of the information was still held as top secret by KGB and GRU, Corso was given a list of materials you can see on screen now. Let's temper our expectations, as this list could easily have been disinformation given to Corso. However, one piece that stands out to me was a silvery tube found in the US in 1975. I wonder if this possibly relates to the August 1974 Chihuahua, Mexico crash I covered, in which a US rapid recovery team relieved a deceased Mexican army squadron of a recovered craft. Possibly the Soviets traced this recovery and found materials missed by the convoy. The Foreign Technology Division was working with lasers, anti-missile missiles, and directed energy weapons near the tail end of Corso's career. Lieutenant General Trudeau retired in 1962, and the Lieutenant Colonel followed him shortly in 1963. Now, what more can we learn about the Foreign Technology Division and General Arthur Trudeau? Trudeau is a member of the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame. The general served in World War II and the Korean War. Trudeau served as Chief of Army Intelligence but was relieved by Alan Dulles, director of the CIA, possibly for his extremely rigorous anti-communist stance. The general was shortly reinstated, and eventually in 1958, the golden age of Army R&D began, according to Corso. Trudeau would then return to Washington as director of Army Research and Development. The general was so influential to the Army, he was one of eight former generals included in the Army's 1970s Oral History Project. Funny enough, when Trudeau was interviewed for this project, Corso was found to be spending time with his friend Trudeau in his kitchen. This speaks to the close relationship of the two and their friendship during and after their service. And outside of Corso, we have only one interesting piece to link the general to UAP. Let's remember all the way back to Forbidden Science, where Dr. Eric Davis claimed Bush Sr. stated he was indeed briefed by Trudeau at the 1968 Mendel Rivers congressional hearings. Now, I'm sure many are familiar with the United States Air Force's Foreign Technology Division that operated out of Wright-Patterson from 1961 to 1991. To reiterate, the office created by Trudeau and chiefed by Corso was not this infamous division. The Air Force program evolved from Air Technical Intelligence Center in 1961 and was assigned under Air Force Systems Command. The division reportedly operated on recovered Russian MiG jets, however. Due to the stovepiping of UFO legacy programs, it would not be shocking to think perhaps this program also engaged with technologies of unknown origins parallel to its Army department. Let's reference U.S. Army Colonel John B. Alexander's book UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Realities. I know I've had my problems with Alexander before and his discussion of the SOM 101 Majestic 12 Special Operations Manual. However, this quote is important. Quote, Corso stated that he had been transferred back to the Pentagon under Trudeau, and a division had been created for him called the Foreign Technology Division. This is not to be confused with the large Foreign Technology Division of the U.S. Air Force at Wright-Patterson, Ohio. It was learned that the Army Foreign Technology Division was formed, as Corso stated, and then disappeared shortly after his retirement, end quote. This is a fascinating point, as after General Trudeau, four-star General Dwight E. Beach took over command of Army R&D, and from there on out, we find nothing of Foreign Technology Division. Why is this Army R&D office proven to exist, yet zero FOIA documents, newspapers, or online articles exist about the correct program? Numerous references can be found to the Air Force's Foreign Technology Division, but not the Army's. I find this very similar to the Army's Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, which was discovered through FOIA to exist only throughout institutional memory in the Army. I do believe this inability to track down the Army's Foreign Technology Division to be of extreme consequence. If Corso's testimony is indeed true, there is much value we can extract here regarding UAP legacy program operations. This would mean the Office of the Chief of Army R&D created a very real program hidden and shadowed from the public eye by the publicity of its big Air Force brother at Wright-Patterson. Throughout the manuscript, Corso would even comment passively on this difference, stating Project Moondust and Bluefly reported materials and intelligence directly to the Air Force's Foreign Technology Division out of Wright-Pat. And we can do some really interesting research by reading a primer on research and development in the U.S. Army. We can see in 1958, under Trudeau, the Army established the Army Research Office under the OCRD due to pressure from civilian scientists, which served as a single contact in the Army to maximize Army R&D efficiency. Remember, Corso stated Army R&D truly began to flourish in 1958 when Army began doing R&D away from civilian and institutions with prying eyes. One can then reason the Foreign Technology Division may have run parallel to the ARO, Army Research Office, out of civilian and congressional oversight. This reasoning can be further supported when the document states the Army Chief of R&D would have a parallel line of authority to handle technical services on matters in his area. This would in turn give the Chief of R&D, Trudeau, authority on assignment of key personnel and allocation of R&D funds to technical services. This R&D primer document also reveals some startling revelations. The Army's initial needs for managing R&D efforts led to the creation of University Research Initiatives, URIs, Independent Laboratory In-House Research, ILIR, and Independent Research and Development Programs, IRADs. Some of you may remember IRADs as a funding mechanism for legacy programs mentioned by David Grush. Furthermore, these URI and ILIR programs would eventually lead to UARC and FFRDC, two types of military and federally controlled semi-private groups that likely operate heavily with UFO legacy programs. What a fascinating document. There is absolutely more to explore here, such as the thesis of how legacy program architecture was born out of Army R&D. I do want to spend some time visiting some of the smaller aspects to Corso's disclosures we glossed over discussing the manuscript. Corso additionally made some extremely interesting claims regarding some information he gathered long after his service. Corso allegedly learned that in February of 1987, Colonel Harold E. Phillips of the Defense Intelligence Agency chaired a Pentagon group called the UFO Working Group. This group, apparently still in existence at the time of the manuscript's writing in 1993, originally consisted of 17 men. One Army and three Air Force generals, DIA scientists, an Army colonel, three NSA officials, a supervisor from the CIA's Domestic Collection Division, as well as a technical team from the CIA Science and Technology Directorate. Well, for one, where is the Navy here, as the Navy is likely up to its eyeballs in UFO legacy programs, such as the Off-World Technologies Division housed at the Naval Surface Warfare Center in Crane, Indiana. It seems strange that between 1987 and 1993, Corso and his UFO Working Group intelligence source would not know or not make mention to the Navy's dealings in UAP legacy programs. But let's go back to the mention of the CIA Science and Technology Directorate and how it is of extreme importance here. By numerous accounts, the CIA DS&T is where the quote-unquote UFO portfolio is held. According to Eric Davis, as well as Chris Sharp and many others, the director of this position, Glenn Gaffney, was the individual who stopped Lockheed Martin from divesting UAP material to AUSAP in 2008. Additionally, former CIA DS&T Deputy Director Doug Wolf helped create the CIA Office of Global Access in 2003, which was accused by excellent journalist Chris Sharp as serving as a logistics coordinator agency alongside JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, for UAP crash retrieval. Corso was way ahead of his time to make mention to this. This UFO working group, according to Corso, also received funding from U.S. Army INSCOM Intelligence and Security Command founder Major General Albert Stubblebine. In the last few projects I have done, I have talked at length about Stubblebein and his likely work in UAP legacy programs, including Fort Huachuca in the 1960s. Stubblebein was also allegedly the man who tried to pay off Stephen Greer in the 1990s, and the alleged founder of the NSA's Men in Black, TREAT, Tactical Reconnaissance Engineering Assessment Team. We'll skip over this for now as we cover this in depth with Edgar Fouché and the Flying Triangle ARVs. But for now, how about this? INSCOM Special Forces Unit, the Illustrious Intelligence Support Activity, ISA, was handed over to JSOC in 2003. The same year, Wolf constructed the CIA Office of Global Access, which allegedly used JSOC for UAP retrievals. ISA is often known as the most secretive and clandestine of JSOC units. Even outside of the UFO working group, just how intimate is U.S. Army INSCOM with legacy programs? And does this working group not sound very similar to a majestic 12-like structure? Let's take this time to briefly point out another distinction between the book and the manuscript. In Day After Roswell, claims are made of working adjacent to Roscoe Hillencoder and the infamous Majestic 12 personnel list under Eisenhower and Truman. Dawn of a New Age sees Corso recognizing the Eisenhower briefing document report, but how he never saw the report at the NSC and White House. The vast majority of criticism against Corso comes from analysis of the Day After Roswell and his claims of technology seeding. The Lieutenant Colonel's military accolades are beyond question. We have already addressed the stark differences between the manuscript and the book. The book clearly added myriad details to spice up the story of Corso. The manuscript is, well, it's tough reading, but it gives us an unbridled look into Corso's experiences. The manuscript was also completed prior to the release of The Day After Roswell. Colonel Alexander and others were shown the completed manuscript around the time of the book's release. While Alexander, Jacques Vallée, and others are still very critical of Corso's, they all maintain the Lieutenant Colonel's story never wavered. Details were never altered, added, or subtracted. Corso sounded like a tape recorder. You could rewind or fast forward to parts of his disclosures and always hear the same details, never any wavering. Allegedly, Corso had but 24 hours to edit the Day After Roswell book, which led to no oversight on all the creative liberties in the piece. One must ask why the subject of this non-fiction book was stripped of all creative control of the project. In his book, John B. Alexander details a letter he wrote to Corso about all the issues related to the day after Roswell. Mind you, these criticisms are all leveraged towards the book, still interesting to keep in mind, and I highly recommend looking at this nonetheless, link in the description. Many discrepancies regarding technology seeding has been thrown at Corso, some of which we have already addressed. Jacques Vallée, for example, well-versed in computer science, stated Corso's assertions regarding integrated circuitry were not documented facts. Colonel Alexander himself had specific issues with the passive night vision system mentioned by Corso. Alexander stated the genealogy of infrared and NVG technology can all be accounted for. Alexander detailed how he spoke to the director of Night Vision Laboratory at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, Dr. Lou Cameron, who flatly denied how an eye lens of NHI aided in passive night vision breakthroughs. Legendary researcher Stanton Friedman was also extremely critical of Corso, associating him with Bob Lazar, which in my opinion, regardless of skepticism against Corso, is very inappropriate. Friedman criticized Corso for his grand story absent of evidence. This is a viewpoint I can absolutely empathize with, but what does Stanton have to say?
Now, entirely differently in terms of background, Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso came out with the book on the 50th anniversary of Roswell, first published right in Roswell, called The Day After Roswell, in which he claims that when he was at the Foreign Technology Desk of the Army Research and Development Command at the Pentagon under General Trudeau, he surreptitiously slipped a filing cabinet full of advanced technology wreckage from Roswell into the hands of American industry, and he saved the world. That's how we got Kevlar and micro-integrated circuits and a whole long list of things. And it was a great story. And the foreword of the book was by Senator Strom Thurmond, the oldest serving member of the Senate, who said nice things about Corso. But in his intro, his foreword says nothing about Roswell.
In his manuscript and book, Corso was indeed what you could describe egotistical, but in his memoirs he never once claimed to have been some sort of world savior. He was very patriotic and simply aimed to strengthen the army. This is obviously not Friedman's fault, as the book was his only available analysis on Corso at the time.
Well, to make a very long story short, when you start checking on Colonel Corso, Lieutenant Colonel Corso, things just don't check out. He provides no validation for any of the claims. There's no index in the book either. They say new documents finally released. There's nothing new in there. And many people have gone through. I know one PhD who was a colonel in the military he sent me a list of 92 false claims made in the book. 92. I mean, just technically wrong all over the place. Well, you can blame that on the co-author, maybe. But some of the discoveries, a physicist just won a Nobel Prize, for example, for work done 3 years before Corso was connected with the Army Research and Development Group. He's a nice gentleman. I met him while he was alive. But his claims, Senator Thurmond withdrew his foreword, wasn't in the next edition of the book, because it was written for an entirely different book about Corso's activities. Corso talked about the FBI, his good buddy Hoover. When his FBI file was released, Hoover had nothing but bad things to say about Corso. Now, it muddied the waters and got a lot of attention. Why would such a distinguished military man? Well, the real military people will tell you. He only made lieutenant colonel after 22 years in. A lot of lieutenant colonels, not nearly as many full colonels. So it's another example of taking advantage, opportunism, if you will. He also claimed that he was a member of the National Security Council. In a sworn statement for a lawyer who was going to go after the government to spill out all Colonel Corso's files. Well, I checked with the Eisenhower Library. He not only was never a member of the National Security Council, which is very prestigious indeed, he never attended a meeting of the National Security Council. He was a liaison between the Security Council and some other groups. It doesn't help ufology to have this kind of thing going on. People accept a great deal, and his book sold well, but I'm sorry, it isn't what it claims to be. it's not a real expose of the truth about Roswell and flying saucers and government's new technology. Cut.
Now, in July of 2024, John Greenwald and the Black Vault published documents released by the FBI on Corso, and no documents discussing UFOs. A portion of these documents pertain to a 1964-65 FBI background check on Corso for his prospective position on the Immigration and National Security Subcommittee of the House of Representatives. Corso had allegedly provided some unfounded claims in the past, according to these documents, delivering a list of Fabian socialists to his good friend Arthur Trudeau. The FBI was unable to validate these claims. Corso was also investigated for spreading claims garnered from CIA sources that Lee Harvey Oswald, assassin of JFK, was an FBI informant. Now, Oswald being either an FBI or CIA informant probably does not seem too unlikely to everybody. Regarding a Soviet defector, Michael Goliniowski, the FBI documents state, quote, "Another government agency has characterized Corso as a parasite who has never produced any intelligence through his own efforts, but has profited from information developed by dedicated government agents and investigators," end quote. All of these critical files on Corso were cross-references and not main files, meaning the FBI never officially investigated Corso. From these files, it does appear Corso liked to quote-unquote waste the FBI's time, making accusations. No content here actually discusses his duties with the Foreign Technology Division, let alone the Army. And of course, it is odd the selection of documents released when they were released. Why are there no documents on Corso's army position, and why are there no documents on the Foreign Technology Division? My greatest issue with Corso arises from a massive first-hand experience relegated to the very end of his manuscript. Remember, Corso claimed to have witnessed an extraterrestrial body in 1947, observed UFOs on radar at ballistic missile sites in 1958 and 1959, and eventually studied materials recovered from UAP crashes for the Foreign Technology Division. Corso's affidavit says as much without reference to the Nike missile site encounters. However, at the end of this manuscript, Corso recounts an incident while in command of a missile silo at White Sands Missile Range. Corso claimed while driving alone in an isolated area, he sought shelter from the heat in an abandoned mine. Within the mine, he claimed to have encountered face-to-face a being of non-human intelligence. The being was drawn in Corso's manuscript and communicated to him telepathically. We can also see him relay drawings of this being in a long-lost interview featured on Weaponized with George Knapp. The being wished to leave the surrounding area, however, active radar interference from nearby installations were preventing its craft's departure. A common theory by Corso and some Roswell researchers is radar systems interfered with craft navigation, leading to crashes. I am still very skeptical on this point. Corso asked the being what he would get in return for lowering the radar coverage. The being responded, quote, "A new world, if you can take it," end quote. Corso would then grant the being's wish when he returned to his installation. This experience was so profound to him, he would often contemplate the meaning of the statement. During life, Corso would even relay this story to John B. Alexander, George Knapp, and possibly others, including a film to his grandchildren somehow Danny Sheehan saw.
I found to be extraordinarily important the little 8mm home movie that Colonel Corso actually produced to be shown to his grandchildren after he died. I found to be extraordinarily persuasive. That he and I got to see the film, but it wasn't supposed to be shown until after he died, and I was shown the film, and it shows him talking to his grandchildren, saying that even though I'm gone now, I wanted to make sure you understood this. And what he did is he talked about the fact that back in 1945, in July, when before we had even dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, while they were experimenting with the nuclear bomb out in the desert at Alamogordo and White Flats, that in New Mexico, he in fact was one of the security officers there, and he said that they were seeing UFOs. He told his grandchildren. From the grave, basically, on the little 8mm home movie, that he had been there and that saw the UFOs, and that he took a lunch break to go leave and went off into the hills somewhere to go to lunch. And he saw one of the craft that had landed. It had been somehow disabled by the radar that was up all around the proving grounds. He had a direct contact with the UFO occupants of the vehicle. And they communicated to him telepathically to please take down the radar just temporarily to allow them to flee. And he actually did that. He told his grandchildren. He went back and as a range officer ordered them to shut down the radar for just a short time to do some kind of recalibration of it. And at that point, the UFO craft fled, shot off into the sky. Now, that's Corso talking to his grandchildren in a private, never intended to be made public, 8mm film. And so I found that quite convincing about Corso. So when Corso reports that he was actually put into possession of some of the technology that had been recovered from the Roswell crash, I tend to give it a considerable amount of credibility. And the fact that the various aerospace corporations try to set forth some sort of long explanation about how they really developed the silicon chip, they really developed the fiber optics, they really developed the other technology that Corso attributes to the Roswell crash, that's exactly what they would do. There's not any doubt about it, that they would obfuscate and they would try to construct some sort of an alternative explanation for how they developed themselves this technology. So I'm just saying that I find the Corso testimony more credible than many people do.
I must be very clear here how Sheehan is indeed incorrect about the 1945 date. Corso claimed this event occurred when commander of the ballistic missile firing range at Red Canyon, part of White Sands. This station was in 1957 to 1958. My issue here is this is a truly consequential encounter, if true. Initially, I believed this passage to be a dream or metaphor until I read more about how many others Corso would tell this story to. Unfortunately, this is an issue that plagues much of the UFO realm. Witnesses stating disclosures, then adding, well, and then this happened, and then that happened, far after their initial disclosures. One would imagine such an intimate encounter with a non-human intelligence biologic would be featured in most of Corso's disclosures. Make of this passage what you will, however, it does leave somewhat of a sour taste in my mouth that such a dramatic encounter is relegated to the very back part of his manuscript. Hey guys, it's UAP Gerb. Thank you so much for joining me as we took this 90-minute deep dive into the claims of Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. Now, before we get started and kind of give this conclusion, a lot of the time you'll see Corso mentioned as Colonel Philip J. Corso. I have never once been able to verify that Corso was indeed a full bird colonel, so thus I try to stay true to what I know as fact and what I've seen on his military records and call him Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. So the reason I took on this project, quite often I'll see people either pro-Corso or anti-Corso, and much of their arguments crux on the Day After Roswell book. A lot of the people who disregard Corso or put away his claims have a unsavory taste in their mouth from the Day After Roswell, whether that be to some of the unsubstantiated and wild claims, such as Corso forcing a CIA guy to self-delete, or some of the egotistical megalomania of Corso in the Day After Roswell book about him being a world savior, and just some of the perfect synchronicities of, you know, perfect descriptions of the Roswell crash and Roscoe Hillenkoetter and the Majestic 12. So I wanted to take a step back and read the pure manuscript, Dawn of a New Age of Corso. This is a 176-page manuscript. If you ever watch this video again, if you're interested, I do recommend reading the full thing. However, it is a very dreadful read. Most things are talked about 8 or 9 times throughout the manuscript, so it can just be a trudge to get through. Now, I do notice that there are still some differences between Corso's affidavit and the Dawn of a New Age manuscript, and this being the description of the encounter at White Sands in 57 and 58, which we just touched on in the end of the video, of encountering a non-human intelligence with almost a different physiognomy to the being he claimed to have seen at Fort Riley in 1947. So that That description still leaves a bit of a strange taste in my mouth due to reading it after about 120, 140 pages into the manuscript. At first, like I mentioned, I did think it was a metaphor, a new world if you could take it, something to teach his grandchildren to learn from, but Corso is alleging that this is a true incident. He not only wrote this in a film, in his manuscript, in a film to his grandkids that somehow Sheehan saw, but also told John B. Alexander, Jacques Vallée, and George Knapp about this experience. So let's kind of dive into some of the things I found very interesting, because I do think there's a lot of very credible statements made in the manuscript. Now, I cannot speak to the veracity of the technology seeding claims. I'm not an expert in integrated circuitry. I'm not an expert in computer science. I'm not even an expert in metallurgy. That was one of my worst classes, material science, in the university. So I cannot speak to that. That is why I tried to put a balanced take, of course, those claims and some traditional history. But what we can speak on is some of the factual accuracies of U.S. Army R&D at the time. You know, I know we analyzed that primer quite a bit, so it was fascinating to see kind of the Army's need for a centralized R&D project under Trudeau, spearheaded in 1958. Just like Corso said, that's when the golden age of Army R&D began. It was also very interesting to see back in the late 50s and early 60s, the U.S. Army was trying to kind of get with semi-private institutions and universities in order to flourish under Army R&D. This is something that we talk about quite often, FFRDCs and UARCs and reverse engineering programs and legacy programs, utilizing these sorts of institutions for probably material study and so forth. And also the Foreign Technology Division. This is something I think is one of the most crucial aspects of this video that I've seen almost nobody else talk about. The Foreign Technology Division under which Corso worked was U.S. Army, not Air Force. This is not the infamous Foreign Technology Division out of Wright-Patt. Now, we can ask ourselves, why is there no information about this Foreign Technology Division? Why can we see nothing about it except in the actual military documents under Corso? I myself have some FOIA documents out to try to investigate this further, but as we've known with the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit with the U.S. Army, there are some weird institutions that somehow exist through institutional memory. I'll be interested in to see if I can pry anything free from FOIA regarding the Army's Foreign Technology Division. However, my hopes aren't necessarily high, that being that if this was indeed one of the first structured U.S. legacy programs, I'm sure we'll get no information. And I do want to touch on that, because if Corso's claims are indeed true, and I look favorably upon the claims of Corso, we'll just say that there's some claims that still bewilder me, like the NHI encounter and so forth. But this program, started in 1960, would likely be one of the first structured U.S. legacy programs utilizing corporations, you know, Bell Labs and some of the Fortune 500 companies, as well as universities and semi-private institutions. So if these disclosures and testimonies are indeed fact, we can extract a lot of interesting data and worthwhile investigation here, seeing how legacy programs were structured and framework. And that is something that could extend to today, which I find highly likely, seeing as I do believe in modern day, or at least the early 2000s, the Army's role in legacy programs has often been R&D to try and equip the modern warfighter with reverse engineer technologies of unknown origin. There will be a lot more to discuss on that in the future. And hopefully, as we move on over time, we can try and crack into some of these legacy programs and talk exactly what about the Army, Air Force, Navy does, and what contractors work under them and so forth. Speaking of contractors, Sperry Rand. Wasn't that an interesting detail? The memoirs of Trudeau and discussed by Corso. One of the companies they met with often was Sperry Rand. And when Sperry Rand went defunct, I'm doing this off the top of my head, which I believe was 86, much of their information and engineering divisions were bought up by Raytheon, Northrop, Honeywell, and I believe Raytheon, as well as Bell Labs. I think one of the most interesting connections here is Bell Labs being owned by AT&T, who in turn had ownership of Sandia National Labs under mandate by Truman. Sandia is a usual suspect mentioned in the Majestic documents, mentioned by Edgar Fouché, mentioned in the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit documents that are still disputed to this day. So There's a lot of interesting data here to kind of analyze a hypothetical or very much real U.S. Army reverse engineering program. And speaking of that, I'm also so fascinated by Corso's discussion of the UFO working group. Wasn't that interesting? Mentioning the CIA Directorate of Science and Technology having a major position on this group of about 18 people on the board. As we know with the work of Chris Sharp, thank you, Chris Sharp. If you ever watch one of my videos, I'm honored. You're an inspiration. But that in 2003, CIA OGA served as a logistics coordinator for UFO crash retrieval with the help of JSOC. As we have just analyzed, the CIA Directorate of Science and Technology, Doug Wolf, spawned the OGA, and then U.S. Army INSCOM and founder Major General Albert Stubblebine, who Corso said funded the UFO Working Group. Under INSCOM in 2003, the ISA, the Intelligence Support Activity, known sometimes as the Activity, the most clandestine of JSOC units, was given over to JSOC. And this was all in 2003, around the time of the OGA's creation, which is allegedly the time the OGA served as a logistics coordinator for crash retrieval. If you don't know much about the ISA, I highly recommend watching some videos on them. They are some true bad people in terms of just their training and so forth. They're really interesting. I'm always interested in learning more about JSOC, but I do want to know what everybody thought about the video. And Corso, after analyzing his claims in a vacuum, purely analyzing his claims without any of the nonsense and extracurriculars from Day After Roswell, what does everybody think? Let's get a discussion going. If you do not know, I have a Discord. Come join that. I'll have the link in the description. We'll probably have some conversations going on about Corso and so forth, because I would really like to talk about that. If anybody has any experience or other information on the Foreign Technology Division, let's get talking, because I think that if you take one single thing away from this video, I would like it to be that the Army had an R&D program in the 1960s called the Foreign Technology Division that there are no documents and no data for. All we know is that Trudeau, followed upon his retirement in 62 by Dwight E. Beach, four-star general, were in command of U.S. Army R&D, the Office of the Chief of Army Research and Development. So there are some kind of clues there for us to work on further. But I hope everybody enjoyed this project. We're coming up on a year anniversary of the channel. I got something a little fun to revisit for that. But thank you all for tuning in. Again, I'd like to know what everybody thought. I got a Patreon in the channel description. I don't gatekeep any content. Everything I do is for the world to see. So if you want to support the channel, only support what you think the channel is worth. With that being said, guys, we will get working right on the next project, and I shall see everybody soon. Please remember to like and subscribe, and thank you so much for tuning in. Bye, everybody.